Okay, good morning, everyone. First of all, a big thank you to those who organized, to Aliza for reaching out to me, Rebecca, who I know from SKA, and some of my former Talmidos here. So thank you very much. It seems like a very wonderful program, and thank you for inviting me to share some thoughts. It's also very special for me to see, number one, former Talmidos, but even just generally young women coming out on your free time, presumably, to learn a little bit, to spend some time learning is amazing. I want to just begin with a thought from the Hakdama to the Mesilas Yesharim, which I'm sure many of you have heard before. And it might sound cliche, but it's really true, especially in this context when we talk about tefillah and some of the things we're going to talk about this morning. But it's really true in general. So Mesilas Yesharim is known as perhaps one of the greatest Musar works of all time. You know, Pirkei Avos maybe number one, and then Mesilas Yesharim, you know, probably number two on the list. And the Mesilas Yesharim, you would imagine, it's one of the greatest Musar works. He probably has many chidushim, many novel ideas, different thoughts in there. And he begins the entire Sefer. You don't have this on the source sheet that I gave out, but he writes, "Hachibur hazeh lo chibartiv lelamei livnei ha'adam es asher lo yadu." I did not write this book to teach people anything they don't know. I wrote it just to remind everyone of things they already know. And he writes that if you look through my book, you'll see that most of these ideas are not new. I'm not bringing any chidushim. I'm just quoting from Chazal. I'm quoting from different sources. And these are things that everyone knows. But because everyone knows them, we don't think about them so often. And we kind of forget about them. So I'm just saying this just literally to remind you of the things that you already know. That's what Mesilas Yesharim writes in the beginning. And I feel like any sheer talk, you know, where we talk about tefillah, is really, you have to begin with that introduction. Because I'm not going to give any major chidushim. Am I the first one, by the way? I'm the first one. Amazing. So I can say whatever I want. And no one, you know, whoever speaks later will be ripping off of me. But so we're just going to give like an introduction to tefillah. But you know, whatever I say, these are not chidushim, these are not new ideas, not novel ideas. These are many things that we know already. I'm sure some of the ideas that we're going to share are things that you've heard before. Maybe you've heard even from me, some of you. But they're kedai to review. And the Mesilas Yesharim actually continues to say that you're not going to gain anything from my sefer by reading it once. He says you're only going to gain if you read my sefer and then you review it periodically and you go over it again, because again, it's not chidushim. If it's chidushim, so you read it once, you get the chidush, and then you move on. But here it's not chidushim. The whole point is just to remind us and to reinforce the ideas that we already know, so that you have to chazer, you have to review. When it comes to tefillah, you know, when I heard that the series of shiurim was on tefillah, so your gut reaction when you hear shiur on tefillah is, oh, like another shiur on tefillah. Right? Like everybody gives shiurim on tefillah, like there's, you know, everybody's talking about tefillah. But then when you think about it for another second, you realize that this is so important. Talking about tefillah is so important because we do it every day. I do it three times a day, probably many of you do it twice a day. You know, we do it so often, and we need to talk about it, we need to reinforce the ideas, we need to review these ideas, and there aren't going to be major chidushim in tefillah that people haven't thought of, you know, over the last couple hundred years. But at the same time, to constantly review these things is so important. Tefillah is an incredibly difficult avoda, and I'm calling it an avoda specifically, and we'll learn more about why it's called an avoda. But it's an incredibly difficult avoda. Why is it so hard? So, some thoughts from the audience. Audience participation here. This doesn't have to be just a monologue. Why is tefillah so hard? It's hard for all of us, myself included, and I'm sure you also find it challenging. Why is tefillah hard? Some ideas. Yes. Good. We'll talk about that. Sometimes they may not be answered, or at least in your perception, they may not be answered, right? So you're asking for X, Y, or Z. You want a certain test to go a certain way, and you get back the grade, and it's not exactly what you planned. You know, you're going out with your friend, and you know you're having a rocky time, and you want things to go well, and it doesn't exactly go as planned. So I'm davening, right? I'm davening. I'm asking for X, Y, and Z, and I'm not getting that response that I'm looking for. Good. Any other thoughts of why tefillah might be challenging? Yeah. What's your name?
Viva.
Viva what? Yeah.
You may not necessarily know what it means.
Good. Right? Tefillah's all in Lashon HaKodesh. It's all in Hebrew. And even if you're Israeli and you know Hebrew well, it's hard. It's hard Hebrew. It's like poetic Hebrew. Many psukim from the Torah, from Tanakh, that are difficult to understand without looking at a translation. Excellent. Good. Hard to understand. Other things, other challenges when it comes to tefillah.
Get distracted,
right? We're very easily distracted. I mean, people have always been distracted, and certainly today, in 2019, people are even more distracted. You know, our attention span is not that long. And to have tefillah, whether it takes us 20 minutes or a half hour, whatever it takes us, is hard. It's hard to focus for such a long time. Good. And we're tired also, right? Most of us are tired. We're so busy, you know, and we have so many things keeping us up. We're tired. People used to go to sleep when the sun went down. No, that was it. They had a candle going. As soon as the candle went out, they went to sleep. We don't do that anymore. So we're tired. We're tired. We're distracted. What else?
We're not talking to a physical.
Excellent. Right? We're not talking to somebody that we see. If we go out to lunch with our friend, it's easy. We can talk to them, right? We can have a conversation. Here, we're talking to the Ribono Shel Olam. We know he's there, but we can't see him. We can't feel him. We can't hear him. Right? We can't sense him. Excellent. So it's very difficult. I'd imagine. Right, going out to eat with someone and they're not talking. Right, you know how hard that is. It's like pulling teeth. Right, you know they're not talking. What's going on here? Right. So imagine you have someone you can't even see. Right, you can't even see, and they're not talking, so to speak. They're not hearing you. I mean, they're hearing you, but they're not responding. Anything else? How about we say the same things, day in and day out, again and again and again, the same Shemona Esrei, right, over and over and over. So these are all challenges. These are all, you know, very difficult challenges, and challenges that can be surmounted, challenges that we can overcome. I'll share just, you know, briefly. I brought here in the sources. I was going to do it at the end, but I guess we'll start with this a little bit. This is just a very brief introduction. The girls who took my Torah Shabbat Peh class in Tefillah will remember this this brief introduction, or I should say, they've learned the brief introduction. So there is a machlok, as we know, between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether tefillah every day is midah oraisa or not. Right? The Rambam holds tefillah once a day is midah oraisa, and the Ramban holds no, it's only when there's an eis tzara, right? Only when there's a time of distress, a time of need, then it's oraisa. But otherwise, it's only midah rabban. So that's just the machlok is Rambam and Ramban. That's really 11 and 12. We're not going to read all the stuff inside. If you want to take a look at it, you can. The Rambam in 13, and I brought several halachos in the Rambam, and we're not going to go through all of these. But the Rambam writes in an amazing, amazing way. And you know, some of you might remember this from class. But the Rambam writes that the mitzvah of tefillah is a mitzvah midoraisa to daven. And he writes that, you know, when tefillah started out, it was just a mitzvah to daven with no real set text, no real set time to daven. Right? I can daven whenever I want. I can say whatever I want. And once a day. So imagine that, right? Imagine you wake up in the morning and you know your responsibility is I have to get up today and I have to talk to Hashem once, right? At some point in my day, it doesn't have to be the beginning, it could be at the end of the day, middle of the day, beginning of the day, whenever it might be, I have to talk to the Ribono Shel Olam once and that's it. And I can say whatever I want.
You're good.
Great, thank you so much. Right? I can say whatever I want. I'm not bound by certain words, I'm not bound by certain concepts. I can say whatever I want, I can talk about whatever I want. Seemingly, that would be a very easy thing, right? That sounds great. That's what tefillah used to be. Tefillah used to be an obligation once a day to connect with your Creator, and that's it. However you want to do it, right? So what changed? So the Rambam writes, and this again, I'm just paraphrasing some of these halachos, but the Rambam writes that what changed was that we went into galus. Right? When we went into galus, what happened? We weren't all so familiar anymore with Lashon HaKodesh. It used to be we lived in Eretz Yisrael, everybody knew Lashon HaKodesh, and we could express ourselves in Lashon HaKodesh. It was great. But now, we don't have that luxury. Because now we're in Galus, and one family might live in Spain, another family might live in Persia, another family might live in, you know, in Russia somewhere, Eastern Europe. And everybody's living in different places, and you know they're learning new languages. So the parents, I always give the mashal when I teach this in class, that I grew up in Great Neck. So I had many Persian friends in Great Neck, right? The Aryeh's and many others, many Persian friends in Great Neck. So many of my friends, their parents were immigrants. They came here from Iran, you know, in the late 70s or early 80s. And the kids, most of my friends were born in America. right? Like right after their parents came, you know, soon after that, that's when they were born in America. Some of their older siblings were born in Iran, but otherwise they were born in America. And inevitably what you saw was that when the parents interacted with the kids, the parents would speak in Farsi, which is the language in Iran, and the kids would respond in English. That's all my friends, that's how they interacted with their parents. Parents spoke to them in Farsi and they spoke back in English. They understood Farsi, and they could probably speak it to an extent, but it wasn't their comfortable language because they grew up in America. So they were comfortable in English. The parents understood English because they were in America and they had to understand English. So the parents speaking in Farsi and the kids speaking in English. Now, if you would tell this kid, you know, I want you to construct a poem in Farsi that describes your innermost feelings. It's very challenging. It's very hard. Again, they can understand Farsi, and they might be able to speak Farsi or maybe write Farsi, but to construct, you know, a sentence or a paragraph or a poem in Farsi to express their innermost feelings would be nearly impossible for these kids. And the Rambam explains that's what was happening when we went into Galus. Because people didn't know Lashon HaKodesh anymore, and the kids were growing up in Spain, in Russia, in Germany, wherever they were growing up. They were growing up with different languages. Their parents might have known Lashon HaKodesh, but the kids didn't really. And therefore, the kids could not express themselves in Lashon HaKodesh anymore. They may have understood it, maybe their parents spoke it, maybe they even could speak it a little bit, but they couldn't express themselves in Lashon HaKodesh. And since Chazal wanted tefillah to be in Lashon HaKodesh, because that's our holy tongue, so there was a major, major challenge. And what ended up happening was that kids stopped davening. Because we know that whenever there's a little bit of a challenge when it comes to davening, or anything else for that matter, what happens? The kids just stopped doing it. So the kids weren't davening anymore. And Chazal saw what was happening, that the languages, there was a language barrier here, and the kids weren't davening because they couldn't construct themselves, they couldn't express themselves in Lashon HaKodesh, and therefore Chazal said, we have to do something about this. So what Chazal did was they standardized tefillah. They standardized tefillah. And they said, we're going to construct a text that everyone, that everyone has to say. And they made the Shmona Esrei, and everyone therefore would have this Shmona Esrei that they would be able to express themselves. Now you might say, well, how can you express yourself if you have a uniform text? Right? That's not expressing yourself, that's just giving me words to say. Right? That's meaningless. So we know, right, the famous Dvar Torah when it comes to the Nesiim, that all the Nesiim brought the same Parshas Naso, all the Nesiim brought the same Karban, right, they all brought the same offering. So what was so special about what the Nesiim did? Because each one could inject their own meaning into the words. Okay? So even though it was standardized, but Chazal's intention was that the words would be expansive enough, they would be broad enough to include nearly anything under the sun that a person might be thinking of. Of course, there are some specific brachos. V'li Yerushalayim Yircha is specific, right? But Rifa'inu is a bracha that just talks about healing. Now, that could be anything. That could be physical healing, that could be emotional healing. That could be healing one person struggling with heart disease, one person struggling with cancer, one person struggling with mental illness. People are struggling with different things. The words also can be taken not in a literal sense, they can be taken metaphorically. Chazal understood all of this, and that's how they fashioned the words. That was their intention. So really, even though it's a set text, and it's a uniform text, and everybody has to say the same thing. But at the same time, it was created with the chachm of the Anshei Knesset HaGadol to be expansive enough and broad enough for us to inject our own personal meaning into the words and our own personal experiences into the words. Now at the same time, it also requires work. Right? Chazal knew that they were giving everyone a text. Now, the kids had to learn that text. So whether the kids lived in Spain or Russia or Germany or wherever they lived, they had to learn the text and understand what it means. Now again, they probably had a leg up on us because their parents at least spoke Lashon HaKodesh, and maybe that's what they spoke at home and they understood it. So they may have had a little bit of a leg up, and they were able to learn it quickly and understand it. But at the same time, they still had to learn the words. Chazal never intended for tefillah to be easy necessarily. Right, this was also a challenge. And the Chazal also realized the challenge inherent in a uniform tefillah. They knew that it could get boring. They knew that it could become rote. But they realized we have no choice. Because if we don't do this, people won't daven at all. It's better if people daven and struggle with davening a little bit to find meaning in it, to understand the words. That's better than people not davening at all. People not davening at all, you have no connection. You know, this past Shabbos was the Yortzeit of Lubavitcher Rebbe. So I spoke about him a little bit at Shal Shudis. I never met him, unfortunately, but I've read about him. And one of the things that I remember reading that was very powerful to me was that in the 1960s, they outlawed prayer in public schools. So you would think they outlawed prayer in public schools. Who cares? What's the difference? We don't send our kids to public school. We send our kids to yeshiva. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was beside himself. He said, what's he so upset about? Right? All the Chabad kids are all going to yeshivas. So what's he so upset about that there's no prayer in public schools? What was his objection? His objection was that everyone in the world needs godliness. We all need the Ribbono Shel Olam. Right? We need him to be there. So if there's prayer in public schools, then first of all, the not from Jews will have some connection to a God. But even the guardian, even the nations of the world will have a connection to a God, which is incredibly important. The Jews, of course, the frum Jews we're not worried about. They're going to be in yeshiva. They're going to learn how to daven. But for all the people in public school, both Jews and non-Jews alike, they need God in their lives. If these kids stop davening, once we went into Golos, what the Rambam is talking about, if the kids stop davening, they don't have the Ribbono Shel Olam in their lives. You can't have a situation like that. You can't have a religion like that. We can't have a connection with him if we're not talking to him. So Chazal knew we had to do something. This solution is not perfect, and it requires hard work on our part. But at least this is something. At least we'll still have a connection. At least we'll still have the opportunity to connect, to talk to him. Now we got to work on it a little bit. Now we have to make it good. So let's talk a little bit about how we do that. Right? How do we do that? So I always say that the main avoda when it comes to tefillah, I feel, is to make tefillah meaningful. Because when things are meaningful to us, even if we're tired, even if we get distracted, but if it's meaningful, we're going to do it. Right? If we're at work, and we find work meaningful for whatever reason, either because we find it inherently meaningful, or because we just want to do a good job, because we want to get promoted, we want our boss to like us, whatever the case is, but we're finding some meaning in it. When we find that meaning in it, we do a good job, and we put our hearts into it, and we work hard at it, and even if sometimes we're tired, sometimes we're distracted, we get the job done, right? Of course, sometimes we might, zone out a little bit or space out, but at the same time, we get the job done. When things are meaningful in life, we manage to do it. So the goal when it comes to tefillah is to make it meaningful. Now, how do we do that? So number one is that we have to learn the meaning of the words. Like I said, Chazal never intended that everyone was just going to automatically understand what all the words of tefillah meant. Right? They never intended that. They knew that we had to work at it. Now again, they had a leg up on us because maybe they understood Lashon HaKodesh a little bit better. Most of us grew up in America. We learned Hebrew in day school. And our knowledge of Hebrew is kacha kacha. So some words we understand, some words we have no clue. And we read through Tehillim and we have no idea what's going on. We don't know what David HaMelech is trying to communicate to us. We must learn the meaning of the words. We must. There are so many beautiful Hebrew siddurim out there. Don't use them. Don't use the Hebrew siddur. Right? Use an English Hebrew siddur. You guys all know Rabbi Kamenetsky, right? Rabbi Kamenetsky is the Rosh Yeshiva of Halb. Okay, Rabbi Kamenetsky uses an art scroll interlinear Hebrew-English siddur. Now I guarantee you that he knows the meaning of the words of tefillah a lot better than me and a lot better than any of us sitting in this room. And yet he uses a Hebrew-English interlinear siddur. Why? Number one, he might be trying to model for his students that you should try to learn the words of tefillah. But number two, because there are probably some words that he's not sure about or some meanings that he's not 100% sure about, and he wants to be able to look while he's davening and see what does this mean. One of the most revolutionary moments in my life in tefillah was a little after my bar mitzvah. I was in Israel for the bar mitzvah of a friend of mine. And they gave out mitzuda siddur. You guys know what mitzuda siddur is? A mitzuda siddur is an English Hebrew siddur, but before they came out with the interlinear art scroll, so you had art scroll was Hebrew on one side of the page and English on the other side. That doesn't help anyone, right? Unless you want to just daven in Hebrew, just daven in English, but it's impossible to follow along at the same time, in the Hebrew and in the English. It's very difficult, right? So for people who don't know any Hebrew, art scroll is good. They can look at the English. And then you have the Hebrew if you want to look at it, so it's beneficial. But if you want to be looking at both, you want to say the words in Hebrew and you want to understand what they mean in English, it's very hard when you have two sides of the page. So what Mitsuda did years and years ago was they split the page down the middle. And they have phrase by phrase. It's literally like two columns, phrase by phrase, what the phrase means. I remember this kid gave out the siddur at his bar mitzvah. And I got this siddur and I looked at it. I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. And I started using it. And it revolutionized my life when it comes to tefillah. Totally revolutionized. Because I realized, if I just look at what the words mean, I'll actually understand what I'm saying. And it just changes the entire experience. So I started using the sitter, and my davening slowed down a lot because I had to, you know, I was looking at what the words meant. So you pick one thing at a time. You know, I'm going to work on Shemoneh Esrei first. Maybe that's the most important. I'll work on this bracha. Once you learn the words, I still have words in my head from the Mitzvah Siddur when I was 13 years old. Because I used it and I began to understand that that's what these words mean. So once you do it, tefillah takes on a whole new experience. So although there are beautiful Hebrew Siddurim and you get the leather bound and the Miller and the, you know, the base tefillah one and you get your name on it and it's beautiful, you know, and your mom got it for you, your friend got it for you, you can use it. But if you don't know what certain words mean, use an English sitter. Use an English Hebrew sitter, whether you like the art scroll interlinear, whether you like the Mitsuda, whatever style you like, or if you like the two pages art scroll, Hebrew and English, whatever style you like, use an English sitter. It's work, right? It requires work to understand what tefillah means. But we have no choice, right? We're never gonna make tefillah meaningful if we don't understand the words. So that's number one. We have to put in the hard work to try to understand what tefillah means, and that means buying ourselves a sitter and doing the work to try to understand what it means. Now, that's in terms of just understanding the words. What about, but I think also, once we understand the words, perspective is also incredibly important when it comes to tefillah. What's the purpose of davening? What's the goal? What's the purpose? Thoughts. I've talked enough. Thoughts.
Connecting.
Good. Excellent. Connecting to Hashem. Other purposes of tefillah. It's early. You guys didn't have the coffee yet. Nothing else, that's it, just to connect? Well, think about it like this. We know how many parts are there of Shemoneh Esrei?
Also, thank Hashem.
Thank Hashem. Right? Think about Shemoneh Esrei, we have three parts. Shevach, Bakash, and Hodah. So seemingly, the purpose is related to all three of those. Thanking Hashem, praising Hashem, and bakasha, also asking of Hashem. It's interesting, the English word for tefillah is prayer. Right? So pray comes from a Latin word, which means, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, you can look it up on Google later, but the Latin word means to entreat, to beg. That in English, that's what prayer means. Prayer means to beg for something, right? To ask for it, to beg for it, to entreat Hashem. Now, that's certainly part of tefillah. That's bakasha. But think about tefillah for a minute. How much of tefillah is bakasha, and how much of tefillah is other stuff, right? Mostly shevach, with also a little bit of hodah. Tefillah is, by and large, shevach of Hashem, right? By and large, shevach of Hashem. A little bit hodah also, and then a little bit bakasha. But bakasha is really limited to those brachos in the middle of the Shemoneh Esrei. All the rest of tefillah that we're saying, all the brachos that we say in the morning, right? Pesukah de Zimra, Aleinu, I mean, all these things, there's very little bakasha. So the ikar of tefillah, when it comes to a Jewish perspective, is certainly not prayer, entreating, begging, or bakasha. That's not the ikar. That's part of it, but that's not the main thing. We call tefillah, tefillah. Tefillah comes from the shoresh palel, pelamed lamed, lehis palel, is to daven, right? That's to pray, that's how we say it in Hebrew, lehis palel. That's reflexive. The word palel, klilim, means judges. So one interpretation that I once read somewhere was that part of the goal of tefillah is to judge ourselves. There was a great article written by Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg in Boca Raton when the first time the Powerball got to like $1 billion. Right? You all remember that? It was like 2 years ago, I think. It happened again, I think, you know, after that. But I think like 2 years ago was the first time it, you know, went to like $1 billion. So Rabbi Goldberg advocated that everyone should buy a ticket. Everyone should buy a ticket. Why? What was his logic? He said, everyone should buy a ticket because it will help you formulate what's really important in life. Because what do we think about when we buy a ticket? We're already planning. We're spending the money already, right? You know, okay, I'm going to give my parents a little money, and I'm going to give my sister, my brother a little money, right? You know, we're already spending the money. So we're thinking about how we would spend the money. How we spend our money reflects on us. It shows what kind of person we are. If a person, one of the first things that go through their head when they think about, I'm going to win the lottery, if one of the first things that goes through your head is, I'm going to buy an apartment in Israel, that shows your connection to Eretz Yisrael. If one of the first things that goes through your head is, I'm going to help my family out, That shows your love for your family. If one of the first things that goes to your head is, I'm going to go out to eat every day, right? That shows something about where we're holding, right? What we spend our money on shows, it expresses, it shows where we're at in life. So he said, everyone should buy a ticket just to think about themselves, to reflect upon yourselves, a little introspection. Where am I holding? What's important to me? What are my priorities in life? Because that's what we do when we buy that lottery ticket. Lehis palel is to judge ourselves. Because when we daven and we ask for certain things, what are we asking for? What's important? Right? What are we focusing on? So part of tefillah is introspection. Part of tefillah is to think about, what am I focusing on? Which parts of tefillah connect to me? Which parts don't connect to me? What am I asking for in Balkasha? What am I davening for? What am I asking for? Am I asking that I should, you know, hopefully get those tickets to the rock concert that I always wanted? That's like my main Balkasha in tefillah? Or is my main Balkasha that I should have a connection with Hashem? That I should, you know, experience simcha when I do mitzvos? That I should improve the relationship with my family, with my friends? You know, what am I asking for? So part of it is judging ourselves reflexively to recognize where we're at, you know, what are our priorities? What things do we focus on in life? That's part of what tefillah is all about. Now, Chazal called tefillah something else. If you take a look at the first source, and again, some of you who took my class will remember these sources. So, the Torah tells us in Parshas Ekev, right, we say this every day in Shema, V'hayim Shemot Yishmo Mitzvosai. So at the very end, if you listen to my mitzvos, Hashem says, what am I asking you to do? La'avas Hashem Elokeichem, to love Hashem your God, ula'avdo b'chol levavchem, and to serve Him with all of your heart, v'chol nafshechem, and with all of your soul. And with all of your heart and with all of your soul. Now we know, famous Gemara, it's also a Medrash, but it's a Gemara in Titus in source number 2. The Gemara tells us, la'avas Hashem Elokeichem, ula'avdo b'chol levavchem, eizogi avode shehi b'leiv, what's considered avode shehi b'leiv, heve omer zo tefillah. That's tefillah. Avodah Shebelev is tefillah. We know that Chazal called tefillah Avodah Shebelev. So number one, in what sense is it Avodah Shebelev? So number one, tefillah is an Avodah. Tefillah is an Avodah. I remember when I was dating, I was very close to a Rebbe of mine. I was in Eretz Yisrael at the time. I was very close to this Rebbe. And he used to give me a lot of guidance when it came to dating. And it's important, you know, it's always important to have a mentor in life, whether it's a woman or a man. But this was my mentor, certainly when, you know, you need to talk things out. So I used to talk to him. And I remember one of the things he said to me was that if you're dating, you have to realize marriage is beautiful, it's wonderful, but it's an avoda. It's an avoda. It's not always easy. It's sometimes hard. It's sometimes challenging, but it's an avoda. Anything in life which is worthwhile is hard work. I remember I was trying to think of a quote from my yearbook in high school. I'm not very creative, and I was trying to like think of, you know, a quote, and I found this quote and I put it in. It's a little nerdy, but there are no shortcuts to any place worth going. There are no shortcuts to any place worth going. Right? When it comes to things that are worthwhile in life, we need to work hard. Think about people that you know who are successful in business. Right? How did they get there? They didn't get there by sitting on their couch and flipping through the channels of the TV. They got there by hard work. Right? They may have started with nothing. They got there with hard work. Any big business, it's because the person, you know, people, shavits, they put hours and hours and hours into their business and they build it up. That's the only way we're successful at anything in life. Right? Anything that's worthwhile is hard work. Avoda shebelev. Avoda shebelev. It's an avoda. It's hard. Tefillah is hard. But because it's hard and because it's challenging, if we put the work in, we're going to gain from it. Right? We're going to gain from it because it is worthwhile. So that's number one. But number two, I think that the second part of that phrase, shebelev, the internal part, that's so important. That's so key when it comes to understanding tefillah. So number one, of course, that shows us that the ikar of tefillah is where? In our hearts. So as much as we mumble the words, right? As much as we mumble the words, we have to think about what we're saying. We have to connect with what we're saying. I always, you know, lament, and this is a problem in shuls and communities throughout America, throughout the world. You know, some, I'm a very slow reader, apparently, right? But I can't keep up with anybody when it comes to davening. I don't know how people daven so fast, right? But they're davening and they're flying through davening, and I can't even say the words, and let alone think about what they mean. Let's say you understand Hebrew, right? Let's say you understand. but you're saying the word so quickly, how can you possibly think about what you're saying? How is it possible? I don't get it. Right? Look around. I don't get it. But that's we're missing the ikkar. The ikkar is shebelev. The ikkar is the intention, the kavana, the understanding, the connection. That's the ikkar. And I think that, you know, but that's one element, just of the understanding, the intention, the kavana. But I think another element of the lev, when we think about lev, lev in Chazal always refers to emotion. Right? Lev is always emotion. Right? Even though we know the heart is you know, not really related to emotion scientifically. But that's how Chazal described, you know, emotion is as it relates to the lev. Tefillah, right? Someone said before, what's your name?
Dina.
Dina said before that tefillah is all about connection. Tefillah is all about connection. I think the most important perspective about tefillah for us is to recognize that tefillah is the bedrock of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's all about connection. Not that the things I said before are not true, they are. But this is the main point of tefillah. The main point of tefillah is connection. The main point of tefillah is a relationship. When we know ourselves, if we think about different points in our life, when our tefillah is strong, the relationship is strong. When our tefillah is weak, the relationship is weak. Right, that's the way it goes. There's a deep connection between tefillah and the relationship we have to Hashem. Relationships are bilateral. You know, they go in two directions. I always say that Torah is how HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to us. We said before that we don't hear Hashem. Right? We don't hear Hashem in our lives. Torah is how Hashem speaks to us. Now, He also speaks to us through events in our life, but we have to be a little bit more open to see those. But if we actually learn the Torah, if we actually read the Torah, that's where He's really communicating, that's where He's really speaking to us. Tefillah is when we speak to Hashem. Torah Hashem speaks to us, tefillah we speak to Hashem. That's the bilateral connection. You know, many people struggle partially with tefillah because they feel disconnected. I teach in high schools, right? I teach in SK, I teach in DRS. And many people struggle with tefillah because they feel disconnected. And it's such a tragedy because what happens when you feel disconnected from tefillah? Inevitably, you start davening less, right? You know, less tefillos, maybe you miss a day. People stop davening, right? When they don't feel connected, Rachman al Itzan, they stop davening altogether. So inevitably, when we don't feel connected, we stop davening. It's such a terrible tragedy when that happens because the only way to get connected is to daven. The only way to get connected is to daven. I'll give you a mashal. And I'll give it to you from marriage because that's how I see it. But you can apply it to all of your lives and friendships and everything. You know, it's the exact same thing. What happens when, actually, you know, let's talk about friendships. What happens when you get into a fight with your friend? I'm sure nobody here, you rolled Sidkonios, and nobody ever got into a fight with their friend. But, you know, theoretically, if you get into a fight with your friend, so what happens? So you get into an argument about something, and then what happens? You don't talk to each other, right? You know, everybody has to cool off. Okay? You see them, you avoid them, right? You don't talk to them. Now, what happens when you don't talk to someone after you get into a fight with them? Does that help to repair the relationship? No. It makes it worse. Whatever distance was created by the argument or by the disagreement, not speaking to each other just widens the distance. It just makes it much worse. Right? You see this with friends, you see this with siblings who don't talk to each other, or Rachman al-Litzan, parents and children. Right? They get into some fight, and then the natural reaction is that we don't talk to each other anymore. We avoid each other. Well, what did you gain by that? I'm so angry I can't talk to them. Right? That the relationship is never going to get repaired that way. It's never going to get fixed. Right? The more we're distant, the more we turn a shoulder, the more distant we feel from the person. We know, and we've all experienced this, you get into a disagreement with your friend, you get into a fight with your friend, you need to cool off. So you might need a little time of separation to cool off. But then, you need to talk. You need to get back together to face each other and to talk and to, you know, talk about what happened, talk about the disagreement, and then make up. And we've all experienced, you get into that fight, you know, you don't talk to them for a day or two, and then you're like, this stinks, right? Because I like them, and we're not talking, and this is just feeling yucky. So let's get back together. We turn to each other, and we talk to each other again. And then we know the feeling, it feels good. Right? When everybody's happy and you get back together and now you're friends again, that feels good. Right? When it comes to the Ribono Shel Olam, it's the same thing. It's a relationship. If we feel disconnected with him and we turn a shoulder and you don't talk to him, it's the same thing with your friend. You feel more and more distant. Because you can't connect if you don't talk. You can't connect if you're not in dialogue. Right? The only way to get back connected with Hashem is to talk to Him, to daven to Him, to open up. That's the only way to get connected. Now, it's not easy, just like it's not easy when you get into a fight with your friend to go back and to discuss and to try to repair. It's not easy with Hashem either, and it's even harder because you can't see Him and you can't hear Him. But that's the avoda. That's how we get connected. We get connected by talking, by literally having that relationship. Another element of the relationship, I think, also is, and this is an important perspective in tefillah, I believe, that part of tefillah is also opening up. Opening up to Hashem and talking about the things that are going on in my life and what I really want and what I really need and what I'm really feeling. I remember, this is another story from when I was dating. I was dating. Sometimes you're dating and you kind of reach a point where, okay, nice girl, nice guy, but, nothing's really connecting, nothing's really happening. And I remember I was going out with someone, and I was at that point where, nice girl, but wasn't really connecting. And I got a suggestion, I remember once, from a shadchan in Baltimore by the name of Mrs. Skolnick, amazing woman, and she was a great shadchan. And she suggested, she actually made up a game. She made up a dating game. And I think now they have an actual dating game that you could buy. But she made up this, it was just handwritten cards. And basically it was a game of opening yourself up. Now, not to take all the skeletons out of the closet, you're just dating this person, but opening yourself up a little bit to express to the person, who you are and what you're feeling about things and what you think about things. Because sometimes we're very guarded. And the goal of the game is that once you open up, you automatically let your guard down, and then you're able to connect. There's a principle, I remember I majored in psychology, which means relatively, really nothing. But I majored in psychology, so I remember a few concepts from psychology. And I remember one concept called transference. There's a concept in psychology called transference. Maybe some of you know this, you're majoring in psychology, or you took AP psychology. Transference means that there's a deep connection that ensues when a therapist and a client have a professional relationship. There's a connection, right? Why? Because since in good therapy, the person's opening up and talking to the therapist about everything that's going on in their life and what they're feeling and what they're experiencing, that creates an incredible bond, an incredible connection between the therapist and the client. And in psychology, they warn the therapist, you have to be careful, right? Because you want to maintain the professionalism. You don't want it to become personal. You want it to, in order to help the person, you need to be a professional, right? But at the same time, there's a very deep connection that a client feels with their therapist once they just opened up. And honestly, even if the therapist doesn't say anything, right? Even if the person doesn't say anything, you just feel close when you open up to someone and you feel like they're listening to you. When we open up to the Ribono Shel Olam and we daven in tefillah and we express to Him what we really want and what we really feeling and what really is meaningful to us in life, that will help the connection. That will help open us up and help open that connection to the Ribono Shel Olam. We believe that He's listening. Again, it's hard because we don't hear Him, we don't see Him nodding or we don't see Him listening, but we believe He's listening. And therefore, when we do it, it helps the connection, it opens us up. We find in the Torah and in Chazal, many sources that talk about this idea of the tefillah is all about forming that relationship. Tefillah is all about the connection. If you look at source number 3, so we know that one of the klalos, when Adam and Chava sinned, so Adam was punished, Chava was punished, the Nachash was punished. So one of the punishments that the Nachash got, if you look at the end of source number 3 in Parshas Bereishis, the Torah tells us, Al gichon chaseleich, that you should slither on your stomach, ve'afar tochal kol yemei chayecha, and you'll eat dust all the days of your life. And essentially what this means is that the snake is going to be able to find his food along the ground, in the dirt, right? Which is what snakes do. That's how they find their food. I can't remember now, I apologize, I can't remember now who said this. I didn't come up with this. Somebody said this, I can't remember now where I saw it. But I remember seeing a suggestion once that what was the punishment here? The punishment was that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was giving the Nachash, I'm going to give you all your food already, easily accessible. And that way, you don't have to talk to me. Because the greatest punishment that you can give someone is disconnecting. In a relationship, one of the most painful things you can do in a relationship, and never ever do this, one of the most painful things you can do is to turn your shoulder. Because when you turn your shoulder and you show I'm not interested in you, I'm not interested in a connection or relationship, that's the most painful thing, much more painful than anything you can say. That's the most, one of the most painful things in a relationship. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was punishing the Nachash. He said, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. You're the instigator, you're the one who caused Adam and Chava to sin, I'm not interested in a relationship. Here, you got all your food, you don't have to talk to me anymore. Right, this is it, you don't have to talk to me. You don't have to daven to me. That was the biggest punishment. When it comes to the Imahos, if you look at sources 4, 5, 6, these are all the sources that the Imahos were barren. Right? Vati Sarai Akara Ein La Valad. Vayetar Yitzchak La Hashem Lenoch Achishto Ki Akarahi. Rivka was an Akara. Vayar Hashem Kisnua Leia Vayiftach Esrachma V'Rachel Akara. Right? Leia was the only exception. Why that's different, that's for a different discussion. But Rachel, we know, was also an Akara. So 3 out of the 4 Imahos were Akaros. Why were they Akaros? So one simple answer of why they were Akaros, I believe, is because Hashem wanted to show that even great people sometimes suffer. Because life is not always easy. Life has challenges. And if we see, you know, people going through life with challenges, look to great people, that they also had struggles. They also had challenges. We just mentioned the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He and his wife were never zochet to have any children. And you look at all the things that he accomplished in life, right? And I'm sure he accomplished amazing things for Klal Yisrael. He was never zochet to have children, right? The Chazon Ish was never zochet to have children. Right? There were people who were never zochet. You know, people just don't have all the brachos that everyone else has. Sometimes when you have great people like the Imahos who struggle with something, so it helps us when we look to them and we say, you know what? If they can struggle with it, we also have our struggles. We can meet those challenges as well. If they met the challenges, we can also meet the challenges. That's one. I think that's one answer. But the Medrash gives a very interesting answer. Not everybody, you know, sometimes it's a little hard to swallow this answer for, you know, philosophically, but the Medrash says in source number 7, V'lama nis'aku imahos. Why was it that the imahos were akaros? 3 out of 4 of them were akaros. Rabbi Levi b'shem Rabbi Shira, Rabbi Chel, b'shem Rabbi Yochanan, she'akarosh baruch hu nis'ave l'tfilosan u'lesichosan. Hashem wanted a relationship with them. He wanted a connection with them. The more they were in pain, the more they turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now again, these were Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, these were great tzidkaniyos. Hashem desired a connection with them. The more they were in pain, the more they turned to Him. Eventually He gave them a child, but imagine the deep connection that was already in place at that time when they had that child because of all the tefillos, because of all those connections with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, I heard someone recently speaking about the fact that, you know, Baruch Hashem, they have several children, but for the first several years of their marriage, they struggled, you know, they couldn't have children for several years. They went to doctors, they went to Gedolim, they went to everybody. And I remember one of the things that he described was the intensity of his tefillah. He said, my tefillah was never so intense before in my life, because there was something that I wanted so passionately. That's what he wanted from the Imahos. He wanted the connection. He wanted a relationship. That's what a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants. That's what tefillah can do. Again, easier said than done, but that's what tefillah can do. Now, how do we deal with the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't seem to always answer our requests? Right? This was one of the challenges that was mentioned. You know, we ask for things, we're not getting it. Right? We're not getting it. So how do we deal with that? It's a good question. It's a very good question. And I'll tell you what I think the best approach in my mind. Everybody might have a different approach that speaks to them, but this is the approach that I think, you know, the best answers this question. It's, again, easier said than done. All these things are easier said than done, but at least here we can have an approach that we can think about. You know, as a parent, one of the things you struggle with is in parenting. Is when to say yes to your kids and when to say no to them. So, you know, I have a son now who's around 2, and he likes to eat. You know, 2-year-olds like to eat. So he eats breakfast, you know, when he wakes up at 6, and he eats breakfast again, you know, when his siblings eat at 8. And then, you know, inevitably, somebody else sits down and he wants to eat breakfast again. So I say, Ashid, you can't have breakfast again. So what does he do? He's 2 years old. He screams. He cries. Now, from his perspective, I'm cruel, right? He wants to eat. I'm not letting him eat. My older son wants to stay up till 10 o'clock, right? I tell him you have to go to sleep at 8 o'clock, 8:30. He starts screaming. From his perspective, I'm cruel. Right? I'm just not letting him do what he wants. He wants to do something. He doesn't see why this is bad. So to him, he wants it. I'm saying no. So I'm cruel. I'm the bad guy. Now I know, as a parent, I have a much broader perspective because I'm not a child. I don't have just the childish perspective and his limited perspective on life. I know that if this kid eats a third breakfast, it's not going to be good for him. It's not healthy. I know that if this kid stays up till 10 o'clock at night, he's going to be exhausted tomorrow and he's going to be a basket case and he won't be able to have a productive and a healthy day. So I know all those things because I'm looking at it from a much broader perspective. They have a much more limited perspective. That's essentially what tefillah is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says no. We view things, think about it for a minute, we view things from an incredibly limited perspective. We look out at life, at everything in life. Everybody's sitting here. There's, you know, what, 20 girls here? Everyone's sitting here with a different perspective. Right? Some of you are thinking about what you're going to do later. Some of you are, you know, connecting to different things that I'm saying. Everyone is experiencing something different with their family, with their friends, and their, you know, with school, with work, whatever you're doing. Everyone has their incredibly limited perspective. Now, we try sometimes to understand other people's perspectives, but at the end of the day, we walk around, whatever we do, we're thinking about ourselves. We try not to be too selfish, but we're always thinking from our perspective. Imagine someone running an organization. They can't just think from their perspective. All the employees are thinking about themselves. The person running the organization has to think globally about the big organization. Imagine a mayor. He's got to think about the whole city. The president has to think of the country. The Ribono Shel Olam has such a broader perspective, such a broad perspective, much broader than our perspective. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees us and our needs and our desires and our wants, and then he sees everyone else in this room, and then he sees everyone else in the community, he sees everyone else in the city, in the state, in the country, in the world. He sees the people that existed before us, the people that are going to come after us. He sees everything. So we want something, we say we want X, Y, or Z, and we cry out to Hashem. And Hashem, who always listens and who always responds, sometimes says no. Sometimes says not right now. To us, it's like that cruel parent. Why won't you let me eat a whole cake? Why won't you let me eat a third breakfast? Why won't you let me stay up till 10 o'clock? Why can't I do X, Y, or Z? We have the childish perspective because our perspective is so limited. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's looking out at the whole world and throughout all of time, has a broad perspective. He sees everything. He sees how everything that He grants us has an effect. And that effect, we might not be able to see. We can't see what's going to happen to us in 5 years. We can't see what's going to happen down the line. We can't see what's going to, how something He gives us is going to affect other people or ourselves. We can't see that. Only He can see that. So when He says no, part of our perspective has to be that I don't get it, but that's okay. Because I'm like that little kid. I'm like that child who doesn't see the whole picture, who doesn't see the whole perspective. You look at a painting, you look up close, and you look at a little, you know, part of the painting, you have no, it looks like it's just a splotch of paint. You don't see how it fits into anything. But when you stand back and you walk to the back of the room and you look at it, and you see the painting as a whole, it just blends in. It looked like a mistake. But it's part of the whole picture. It's part of the whole painting. It's part of what makes that painting beautiful. And that's the perspective that we have to have. Now, sometimes we'll be able to see the big picture. Sometimes down the line we see, oh my gosh, you know, Baruch Hashem, that I did not get what I was asking for. Right? Baruch Hashem, that relationship did not work out, because that would have been terrible. Baruch Hashem, I was late to work, right? All the stories of the, you know, the World Trade Center. I know that some people, Rahman al-Litzan, many people died. And then you have stories of people who were late that day, right? There's someone in our community, Mr. Schoenbach, has a crazy story. He was, you know, he's late to work that day. His kid was making him crazy with some scholastic book order form, and he had to, you know, he missed his train. And he got to work later. Because of that, he survived. Right? So sometimes we're able to see it. And then the Chasam Sofer says in the words in Kisisa, V'ra'isa es achorai ufanai lo yeru. Moshe asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu to see. He wanted to see Hashem. Hashem said, V'ra'isa es achorai. You could see my back. Ufanai lo yeru. Says the Chasam Sofer. What that means is that usually we'll never understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ways fanai. In front. Looking at it head on, straight on, we're almost never going to understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu's doing. Achorai. That you can sometimes see. Even that, not always. But then you can sometimes understand. Looking back, sometimes you can understand why HaKadosh Baruch Hu did certain things, why I got this, I didn't get this, why I was in this situation. Sometimes I can look back and I see how things unfolded. I was like, wow, you know, Baruch Hashem. Sometimes you can see that. But sometimes we can't. But we have to trust. You know, part of parenting also. Parenting is, I think, a good mashal, actually, for our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because that's what He is, Avinu Shel HaShemayim. You know, parenting is all about, it's your kids trust you. It's an amazing thing. You see, like, you know, once kids learn their parents, they trust their parents. They don't trust other people. Right? When a stranger takes a little kid and wants to hold them, they scream. Why? Because they feel like they're threatened. They don't know what's going to happen in this person's arms. They know when they're with their mother, when they're with their father, nothing's going to happen. They're going to take care of them. They're going to change the diaper. They're going to give them food. They know that they're going to get taken care of. This other person, I have no clue. So I'm afraid. We trust our parents. I see my kids. I walk down the peninsula every Shabbos to get to my shul. So I walk with my kids. And kids are scared. Peninsula is a crazy street, right? I mean, it's scary even for adults. But for kids, it's also scary. But when a kid holds a parent's hand and crosses the street, they're not worried about anything, right? They don't know when it's safe to cross the street, when it's not. But they know that if they're holding their parent's hand, they have nothing to worry about. I read a beautiful story. My kids, some of you guys might know Living Emunah. You know the books Living Emunah? So they have Living Emunah for adults, for teens. They have Living Emunah for kids. So I read some of the stories to my kids. And one of them was like, I started crying. It was a crazy story. Hopefully I won't cry. But there was a beautiful story of, some of you may have read it. It's a beautiful story of a plane ride. You know, all the passengers are getting onto the plane. And this little girl comes onto the plane, like, unattended. You know, she's like, she's not with anyone. So sometimes, you know, you have that, and usually they're wearing, like, some sort of necklace, and, the stewards and the stewardesses take care of them. So this girl sits down, and she's taking out her toys and whatever, and the plane takes off, and it's flying. And all of a sudden, it hits, like, crazy turbulence, but, like, nuts. And the people are buckling up, and, you know, the plane's jerking back and forth, and everybody's, like, davening, and people are scared, people are crying. And this lady's sitting there, and she's sitting next to this girl, and she sees the girl is, like, calm, serene, peaceful. She's, like, playing with her toys. And the lady's, like, doesn't understand. She's, like, all the adults are freaking out, and this kid, she feels the same emotions that we're all feeling. So how come she's not afraid? How come she's not scared? All right, whatever. So afterwards, you know, the plane calmed down, and everybody was fine, and Baruch Hashem, they landed safely. And as they're landing, she turns to this little girl, and she says, you know, I noticed that you weren't really scared at all when things, you know, when there was turbulence. Why weren't you scared? So she said, because the pilot's my father. So she said, I knew that he was going to be able to fly the plane. If we recognize that the pilot's our father, if we recognize that we're on the plane, and Kadosh Baruch Hu is our father, even if sometimes there's turbulence, right, we know that he's going to take care of us. We know that he's going to take us to our destination. We know that everything is going to be okay. We have to trust in Hashem. Just like kids trust in their parents, they don't always like what their parents say. They might kick and scream when their parents say no to them. But at the end of the day, they trust their parents and they know that their parents love them. They know their parents want what's best for them. So that's the same thing that applies, I think, in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The last thing, I think, which is important when HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to say no, or doesn't seem to answer our tefillos, the last perspective is not just to recognize that we trust Hashem and there's a bigger picture and that He sees it and that we don't, which is incredibly important. But there's something else that we say actually in Slichos, which is based on a pasuk in Tehillim. We say it in Slichos of the Yom Chamishi of Aseres Meitshuva. If you look in source number 8, so we say Yiratzu Milfanecha Shomea Kol B'chios, that it should be the will before you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who hears our cries. Shetasim Dimoseinu Binod Chalihios, that you should place our tears in your flask to remain there. So what does that mean? It's based on a pasuk in Tehillim in Kapitel Nun Vav. The pasuk says, Nodi sefarta atos sima dimasi benodecha, right? That we're asking Kadosh Baruch Hu to place our tears in His flask, and the Radak in Tehillim says, what does that mean? Klomar shetishmerem velo tishkechem, right? Keep our tears there and don't forget about them. And I think that this is an incredibly important idea. You know, sometimes we daven. You know, people ask me sometimes, you know, I'm davening for this chola. And, you know, Rachmana Litzlan, the chola passes away. So what happened to all those tefillos? Now, people were learning in their schos, they were davening in their schos. What happened to all those tefillos? So one thing is you don't know how much your tefillos helped. You don't know. Maybe this chol was supposed to suffer much more, and they didn't because of your tefillos. We have no idea what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's original intention and what he might have changed because of our tefillos. So maybe the chole lived longer and was able to spend more time with their family. Maybe they suffered less, right? Maybe they were able to live out life a little bit longer with a little bit more quality because of our tefillos. We have no idea what our tefillos accomplished. But I think also something that's important to recognize is that we don't know what our tefillos can do in the future. Maybe your tefillos are going to help down the line. Maybe your tefillos are going to help this person's children or their grandchildren. At the story, Chazal tell us that Avram Avinu, when he passed by Shechem, he passed by and then he realized, he said, one second, I feel something here. I have to go back and daven. I don't know what it's for. I know it's for the future. And Chazal tell us it was for Shimon and Levi. And part of the reason, according to some of the Mefarshim, why Shimon and Levi felt confident as they went into Shechem is because they knew that their grandfather, great-grandfather, had davened in that place for their Hatzlacha. And they felt confident with that. So you never know what's going to affect later. I'll tell you a personal story, which I saw. And again, I'm not a Navi. You don't know 100% how these things turn out. But, you know, it just hit me when I thought about this at one point. So, unfortunately, my mother passed away when I was 18, right after high school, like in the beginning of my Shana Aleph. So throughout my senior year, she was sick and davening. At that time, right, you guys know high school seniors, you have plenty of free time, right? You're not doing much. I mean, I took a lot of APs and things like that. But you have time to do things. So what was I doing then? I was davening. I was learning. Are you doing all these things, for my mother's refuah shleimah? Unfortunately, she passed away in the beginning of my Shana Aleph. Fast forward now. How many years? About 5 years ago, my father had to have what was supposed to be routine heart surgery. He had the heart surgery, and in recovery, he had a stroke. I don't know exactly when it happened, but he had a stroke. And he was a mess. Couldn't walk, couldn't swallow, couldn't do anything. And at that time, I had just had my third child. I was living in Staten Island. He was in a hospital in NYU in the city. I couldn't, and I was working full-time. So I used to working full-time here in the Five Towns. So I used to drive, go to work, come home to Staten Island, help my wife put my kids to bed, eat something quickly, and then I would go to the hospital at night and spend time with him. Baruch Hashem, he's doing great. He had almost a complete refuah shleima, and you would never know if you just met him. You would never know he had a stroke. Baruch Hashem, a lot of siyata d'shmaya. But I remember thinking to myself, later, like a couple of years later after this happened, that when my father was sick, I didn't have the luxury of saying Tehillim all day, of learning all day for him. I was busy. I had a family. I had jobs. So I did what I could. Of course, I davened for him. Of course, I did things for him. But I didn't have the luxury to spend all that time davening and putting all my kochos in for his refuah shleima. Who knows? I don't know. I'm not a Navi. But who knows? Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Shetasim dimoseinu b'not chalihos. For whatever reason, when I was 18, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, your mother's not going to make it. She's not going to be able to live. But I'm going to take your tefillos. I'm going to store them up. I'm going to hold them for one day. When you need them. Right? When you're not going to have the time to daven and to learn and to do all the things that you need to do. Right? I'm going to store those tefillos. So we never know what our tefillos accomplish. So even if it seems like a Kadosh Baruch Hu says no. You never know what your tefillos can accomplish for that person. You never know what your tefillos can accomplish for their children, for their grandchildren, down the line. You never know what your tefillos can accomplish. So hopefully some of these ideas, again, just chizuk, nothing, no major chidushim, but just chizuk of ideas to think about when it comes to tefillah. And hopefully all of us can get some chizuk and can work to improve our tefillah together. Thank you for coming.